Okay, great. So it's a pleasure to welcome Yassine Ali Hamoud as our speaker today. So Yassine is a theoretical cosmologist working at New York University. He got his PhD from Caltech, and then he was a postdoc at the IIS in Princeton and at Johns Hopkins before joining the faculty at NYU in 2017, I believe. So he's done lots of interesting work across a very wide range of topics in cosmology and astrophysics. So this includes, for example, recombination, massive neutrinos in large-scale structure, spectral distortions in the CMB, dark matter, primordial black holes, basically everything. And today, Yassine will be telling us about some interesting recent work that he's been doing on trying to understand the stochastic gravitational wave background and pulsar timing arrays. So Yassine, you know, please take it away whenever you're ready.
Okay, well, thank you very much for the very kind introduction, Neil. So I'll be telling you about work which is outside of my usual main research area in cosmology, and this is gonna be about pulsar timing arrays, and specifically about in terms of the data analysis aspect of the pulsar timing arrays. And this is work in collaboration with Tristan Smith and Kata Mingarelli, and you can look up all the details in these two papers that we published last year. Okay, so we've come a long way since the very first telescope in terms of electromagnetic observations. And in addition to the, as you know, the visible spectrum, we now have telescopes that cover a very broad range of wavelengths, ranging from gamma rays at the very shortest wavelengths all the way to microwaves and radio. I'm sure lots of you have worked on the cosmic microwave background. So I want to start my talk by giving you a brief introduction as to the success story of the CMB to draw some parallels with pulsar timing arrays. So in 65, one single number was detected about the cosmic microwave background, which is the overall amplitude of the spatially averaged CMB. So this overall amplitude can be translated into a temperature of about 3 degrees Kelvin. Already with this one single number, we could have a very, this already revolutionized our understanding of cosmology. We could already have a good idea of the thermal history of the universe, when the universe underwent matter radiation transition, when recombination happens, et cetera, et cetera. It took about 25 years before more than one single number, we had more than one number about the CMB. And this was in the form of the CMB frequency spectrum, which was first measured by the FIRES instrument on board the COBE satellite and almost simultaneously by the COBRA experiment, the COBRA rocket. And from this, we were able to then extract some stringent, since this tells us this, the CMB is consistent with a perfect black body within some very small distortions, we're able to extract some very stringent bounds on how much energy was injected or extracted into the early universe, starting from a few months after the Big Bang. And lastly, what's probably most of you have been, or a lot of you have been thinking about and working on, is CMB anisotropies, which were the first full sky map was measured by, again, the COBE satellites. And since then, WMAP and Planck have provided increased maps with increasing angular resolution and sensitivity. And there's also a plethora of ground-based experiments which have measured parts of the sky. In addition to the temperature anisotropy, we also have now measured the CMB polarization. And as you all know this from this information, we have now entered definitely into the era of very high precision cosmology, and we've measured lots of different parameters about the universe, including very precisely how much dark matter there is, even though we still don't know what dark matter is. Okay, so this is just as a brief summary of the CMB success story. Now, in terms of gravitational waves, we are in the very, very early days of gravitational wave astronomy and perhaps cosmology. So in terms of this frequency spectrum, the equivalent for gravitational waves is shown here. So on the high frequency regime around kilohertz or so, LIGO is so far the only gravitational wave instrument that has actually made a detection, a direct detection of gravitational waves. In the millihertz regime, LISA is supposed to come online soonish. I'm not sure exactly the detailed timeline. And in the very low frequency regimes, in the nanohertz regime, so nanohertz corresponds to periods of about 10 years or so, pulsar timing arrays have actually been taking data for a decade. And the hope is that they might measure gravitational waves in this very low frequency regimes. The kind of astrophysics that can be probes are very different depending on the frequencies, and pulsar timing arrays are sensitive in particular to supermassive binary black holes, as I'll briefly discuss. Okay, so this talk is going to focus on this region of the gravitational wave spectrum. So the sources of gravitational waves at these decade-long periods are the main, you know, sort of the vanilla source that one expects is the joint radiation of the many supermassive black hole binaries that exist in the universe, and that together would generate a stochastic gravitational wave background. The characteristic amplitude of the strain of this gravitational background was first calculated by Stirl Finney in 2001. And so if one were able to measure this one single number, the overall amplitude of the gravitational background, assuming a specific frequency dependence, which is analogous to the black body for the CMB, one would learn something as shown here about the typical masses of these supermassive black hole binaries and the typical typical abundances. Okay, other sources of gravitational wave background, gravitational waves at these very low frequencies, you could have primordial gravitational waves, either generated truly primordially or sourced at second order by scalar perturbations. And to get year-long periods, you need commoving wave numbers about 10 to the 6 inverse megaparsecs. And lastly, there are lots of exotic, what I would call exotica, which may not be exotica for people who do work on them. For example, cosmic strings, which could also generate stochastic gravitational backgrounds in the nanohertz frequency region. Okay, so the current status of observations, basically, I'll just get straight to it, is that we're still in the pre-Penzias and Wilson era for pulsar timing arrays. Okay, so the first step is to try and measure one single number, just like we were trying to measure one number for the CMB in the 60s. So that one single number would be, if I assume that, say, the gravitational background is fully isotropic, if I assume a very specific frequency dependence, then the only number that is to be measured is the overall amplitude. And so currently, this plot is showing that if you, as a function of the power law that you might pick for this characteristic strain frequency dependence, the NanoGraph collaboration has been able to set upper limits on the characteristic strain at a characteristic frequency, say, of 1 year. As a note, you probably all have heard about the 12 and a half year analysis from the NanoGraph collaboration, where they released a detection of a so-called common process. This common process cannot be interpreted as the gravitational wave background, as is made very clear by the collaboration. So one should instead look at this blue curve, which analyzes the data, including the correlations that are expected from the gravitational background. And here again, this blue curve shows you an upper limit on the amplitude of the gravitational wave background, even though this was not put forward by the collaboration, because I guess it's less exciting. So looking ahead, hopefully soon, this one number will actually be measured. Okay. Then the next steps will be, just like for the CMB, to try and measure beyond one number and measure the frequency spectrum of the gravitational wave background, assuming, say, that it is isotropic. Okay, so far, when there are, again, upper limits shown in this black wiggly curve here on the frequency spectrum, so basically a frequency by frequency upper limits. And so if one were able to measure the spectrum, one could be able to know, for example, are the supermassive black hole binaries mostly actually circular, or are they typically on eccentric orbits? Do they only in spiral due to gravitational wave radiation, or perhaps do they interact with their environment, with the gas and stars around them, which make them emerge faster, which make them lose energy, not just due to gravitational waves, but also to other processes, in which case you would get some loss of power at low frequencies. So that would be,
yes? May I interrupt you? So concerning this 12 and a half year analysis, you say the signal cannot be interpreted as a gravitational wave. So it means we don't have enough evidence, or there is contradiction with gravitational wave interpretation?
I will clarify exactly what I mean in a couple of slides. And if okay. I haven't, you can ask me again.
Okay, thank you.
So this should be clear. Even though this is not the main purpose, but yeah, I'll clarify exactly what I mean. Okay, so beyond the frequency spectrum, just like for the CMB, looking ahead, at some point perhaps we'll be able to detect anisotropies in the gravitational wave background intensity. And in fact, we know that, you know, there should be some anisotropies, because if these supermassive black hole binaries are the main source of gravitational wave background, well, they're not. There's not an infinite number of them, and so there should be at least some Poisson anisotropies in this stochastic gravitational wave background. And looking even further ahead, that might be polarization, and I'll let you think about why I've represented this polarization by headless crosses as opposed to headless arrows for the CMB. Okay, so there are two kind of questions, directions one can and should work in terms of looking ahead. The first one is, of course, what kind of physics might we learn? What kind of properties about, you know, supermassive black holes and nature in general could we learn if we measure more than this one single number, if we measure anisotropy, spectrum, et cetera? And the other kind of line of questioning, which is I'm going to explore in this talk, is, well, what can we measure in the first place? We have the instrument in this case is a pulsar timing array. It's not really an instrument that one can, you know, tweak so much. You only get the pulsars that nature provides you. And you need to wait a long time before they contribute effectively to the data. So another important question to ask is, what can we measure in the first place? In other words, we need to be able to make forecasts about what can be measured by this instrument. So why a Fisher formalism? So first of all, by Fisher formalism here, I mean, very broadly speaking, some kind of theorist reduction of the data analysis pipeline. Hopefully a theorist reduction which still contains the most essential elements and still allows you to make robust and accurate forecasts, but doesn't require you to actually analyze data in some to make some predictions. Okay. So this is part of the answer to, I think it was Sergei's question, that to detect the gravitational wave background, and I'll clarify this again a bit further, you can only do so by cross-correlating different pulsars, okay? Now, for the nanograph, for example, current pulsar data analysis, it uses 45 pulsars, which corresponds to 990 pairs. There is hope that the square kilometer array will detect hundreds, some people even say thousands, of new millisecond pulsars. Okay, so the millisecond pulsars are those with the period of millisecond which happen to be very stable and are used for this kind of analysis. So if you detect hundreds of such new pulsars, you will have tens of thousands of pairs. And so you better have some simple tool, but still robust tool, to make forecasts without having to run a complex Monte Carlo Markov chain analysis, which would be very computationally demanding if you have tens of thousands of pairs to account for. And moreover, it might not even be possible to really run a brute force Monte Carlo analysis with all of the data. So you need to have some tools to help you guide and optimize your full-blown data analysis. So this is the underlying motivation to why build a Fisher formalism, which currently was not existing. So before moving ahead, and I will answer your question, Sergei, still in a few more slides, I want to draw some analogies and differences between electromagnetic waves and gravitational waves to just make things very clear. So first of all, so we're going to talk about stochastic gravitational waves. I want to point out that astrophysical sources of electromagnetic waves are always stochastic, even what we call point sources. The radiation from these point sources is made of an extremely large number of incoherently emitting microscopic emitters, atoms, molecules, whatever. Even if you look at masers, okay, even if they emit at the same frequency, they all are incoherent in phase. Okay, you can think of masers are the superposition of many masers with different phases in the electromagnetic field. Okay, so astrophysical sources of electromagnetic waves are always stochastic in nature. On the other hand, one can detect deterministic gravitational waves from a single, basically giant gravitational wave atom, like a single binary. This is what LIGO has done, okay? And there, so one can separate deterministic sources of gravitational waves and the stochastic gravitational wave background resulting from the superposition of many sources, okay? And the tools that you use for the analysis are very different if you assume if that you're looking for some deterministic signal versus some stochastic signal. So the focus of this work is purely on the stochastic gravitational wave background. A second analogy here, it's really an analogy, is that the in vacuum, the electromagnetic field is transverse, and as a consequence, the electric field has two independent degrees of freedom. Okay, it's transverse to direction propagation. And the gravitational wave strain, Hij, which is the fundamental quantity for gravitational waves, is a symmetric trace-free tensor, which is also transverse. And this gives you, in both cases, two independent components. So we have, in both cases, two independent components. Not quite the same geometry. One is a rank two tensor. The other one is a rank one vector. Okay, so now focusing on the stochastic gravitational wave background, you know that you can, from electric, the stochastic electric field, you can build this correlation tensor, okay, this cross power spectrum between two components of the electric fields. The component which is proportional to the identity matrix projected perpendicular to the direction of propagation is the total intensity of the gravitational waves, of the, sorry, electromagnetic waves. And I'm dropping all factors of 4 pi here. There is a component which goes as epsilon ijk times omega k. This is the circle of polarization, this V. And then the remainder, so this gives you two components, a scalar and a pseudo scalar. And then the remainder, two components, so 2 times 2 is 4, is the linear polarization. Okay, this is symmetric and trace-free linear polarization. For gravitational waves, we now can build a rank 4 power spectrum tensor by cross-correlating HAB and HCD, okay? And here I'm also dropping all the Dirac functions of frequencies. They are implied. So there is one piece which is essentially the trace, okay? Just like this is the trace up to some factors of order unity. So there's a purely geometric piece which you can build out of Kronecker deltas and omegas, which has the required symmetry properties, trace-free in each pair, et cetera, et cetera, symmetric, et cetera. So there's a well-defined way to define this piece. So there's a scalar piece, there's a pseudo-scalar piece. And again, one can define a rank four tensor, which generalizes this guy here. And there are two leftover components, which are the linear polarization. So in this talk, I will focus on just the total intensity. One of the things we did in the first paper is to really write all of these in terms of purely geometric frame independent quantities. So all of these curly tensors, which really helps with the calculations rather having to use H plus H cross and do all sorts of rotations when you change directions in the sky. You'll see exactly what I mean later. So let's talk about the basics of how pulsar timing arrays work. So on the left, I'm about to show you a very computer intensive simulation of a neutron star with a magnetic field. So the idea is that neutron stars have some of the neutron stars have a large magnetic field. If its axis is not aligned with the rotation axis, then and if the beam of the radio emission is aligned with Earth, what you see on Earth is, as a function of time, a bunch of bursts of radio intensity, which are periodic in time. Then what you do with the data is, as a function of pulse number, you estimate the arrival time, the time of arrival, TOA, of these pulses. Then you fit through this data a so-called timing model. Okay, so if the pulsar was really rotating at perfect periodicity, this would just be a straight line, but perhaps the pulsar is slowly spinning down. Perhaps it is part of a binary. Perhaps the pulsar has some long time scale deterministic changes in its period and period derivative. So you account for these long time scale smooth variations by fitting some smooth timing model. We then subtract the data points from this timing model and what remains is the so-called timing residual. Okay, this is the fundamental data quantity that one works with. So this is some time residual as a function of time of arrival. Okay, this is some real life example of one of the pulsars observed by the NanoGrav collaboration, which has been observed over, well, in this case is 12 and a half years. And so this is showing at different radio frequencies, these timing residuals, which as you see are sort of consistent with noise because that's the whole point. You subtract out some smooth model to them. Okay, so then you take this function. Here I'm again describing this in the theorist's sort of simplifying way. So Fourier transform this function, right? And then you're going to compute this power spectrum and the cross power spectrum of this timing residual between different pulsars. So what are the sources of the contributions, different contributions to these power spectra and cross power spectra? So first of all, there is the intrinsic pulsar noise. So your pulsar may not be a perfect, again, rotating it with a perfect periodicity, not only may it slow down over time, but also maybe there's some pulsar quakes or whatever, some sources of noise, which we are difficult to predict because, you know, this is a pulsar by pulsar basis. So if you take the autocorrelation of one single pulsar timing residual, so the sources of noise only are proper to each pulsar, they're intrinsic to each pulsar, so they are uncorrelated between the different pulsars, and they do give you some autocorrelation, which I denote by sigma p squared here. Then, so there are other sources which I will discuss in the conclusions, but our main focus here, the other source of cross-correlation between timing residuals is the ones which are induced by gravitational waves, stochastic gravitational waves. So if you have some gravitational wave back, gravitational wave strain, HAB, okay, this will, and this is simply a geodesic calculation, non-geodesic calculation, you will find some timing residual, which is basically obtained by projecting the direction. So P hat is the direction of the pulsar onto this gravitational wave strain and integrating over all directions of propagation. So once given this, you can then compute the cross correlation of two different pulsars, P and Q. This gives you the cross power spectrum of gravitational wave induced timing residuals. These, if I only consider a total intensity for the gravitational background, this will be some linear function of the total intensity. Okay, this total intensity is a map. It's even though it's a scalar, it still is a scalar that depends on direction, just like the temperature of the CMB, say. And so there is some function, some map that gives you the linear relation between this total intensity and the timing residual. Okay, this function we have given an explicit relation equation for the first time in this paper. So again, all of these previous works work in terms of specific bases, H plus, H cross, and then you have to do some rotations here. By considering these purely geometric quantities, we were able to write things in a, I think, rather simple way. And so we've defined here this pairwise timing response function. I will use one more geometric notation, which is that these integrals over directions of gravitational waves, I'm going to denote them by a dot product. So if I have two maps, which are functions of directions of gravitational waves on the sky, I'm going to denote their dot product as their integral, their average over the sky direction. Okay. So go back to Sergei's question, even though this is not the main point of this talk here, the NanoGrav result, this common process, comes from only analyzing autocorrelations. Okay. And the blue curve I was showing is when you account for these cross correlations. So the autocorrelations also contain some gravitational wave background. So the sigma p squared also actually, this also has some contribution to this, but you cannot disentangle them unless you have some, you make some assumption about the intrinsic noise.
And they know that it's common process because it has the same spectrum for different pulsars.
Yes, so you have to make some assumption, etc. about the spectrum of the intrinsic noise, etc. But So you better believe your assumptions about the spectrum, you know, very.
Right. No, but yeah, but I remember, okay, it's true that they're saying they don't observe enough autocorrelation to argue for gravitational wave interpretation, but I just want to understand what's your take. So is the fact that they don't observe enough autocorrelation, does it rule out gravitational wave interpretation or just not sufficient?
And my take is that they are not sufficiently agnostic. You have to be, okay, my take is as follows. If someone had isolated a pulsar in the lab, mm-hmm. then they can do what they did. Mm-hmm. Barring this, one has to be completely, completely, completely agnostic about the intrinsic noise of pulsars, mm-hmm. and they are not. Mm-hmm. That's my take. So the only thing that you can do to extract, and they, you know, this is known. Again, I'm not saying anything that they're not saying. To really claim detection of gravitational wave background, you need to use cross correlations because that's the only thing that's mm-hmm. where intrinsic noise drops. So this is why they call it a common process. Mm-hmm. Rather than a gravitational wave background.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I see.
So yeah. So this.
Follow up on that, Yassine. Sorry. They have some upper limit on the cross correlation, right?
There is some upper limit. So you have
an. Upper also limit. Have like a detection of the uncorrelated.
Well, they have a detection of some uncorrelated thing.
Yeah. Exactly. So I was just wondering what the significance of that uncorrelated detection was. Right, so if it's like 10 sigma, we would have expected to see the cross correlation, right?
I don't remember exactly the significance, but maybe we can discuss this at the end because it's not really the topic of here, but yeah,
true.
Yeah.
Can I, I know you're trying to move on, but can I ask one quick question?
Yeah.
If you're looking for gravity waves, how does the signal to noise of the autocorrelations compare to the cross correlations? I just would have guessed that with 45 pulsars, that the cross correlations would have better sensitivity.
But again, so I think you can make such statement. So your autocorrelation is equal to completely unknown intrinsic noise plus gravitational wave background. So if it's completely unknown, I don't know how you can claim anything.
I understand and I agree. Right?
I can literally say, okay, here's this thought experiment. I have 45 pulsars, all of them have an intrinsic noise, which scales as f to the minus 2/3. Can you, tell beyond any reasonable doubt that this cannot possibly be due to gravitational waves? That this cannot possibly be due, to intrinsic noise? No, we don't know. Maybe all the pulsars actually happen to, because guess what? They are all the same kind of astrophysical objects, maybe they all happen to have similar, power law noises, and no one can prove this, that this is not the case beyond reasonable doubt. So I think the whole common process analysis is moot, but this is really kind of really beyond this talk. This is something I'm working on to make this beyond just this kind of statement. I wish this wasn't recorded now. But anyway, so we can discuss this later.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, I got a little bit confused. Which part is that, that we do observe the data? Are you saying the data that is degenerate to the autocorrelation and cross-correlation, or we can disentangle them in the...
So let me go back. Let me go back to this. So you observe this data, the cross correlations between two pulsar timing residuals of different pulsars. These have a contribution which is intrinsic plus a contribution which is proportional to the gravitational wave background intensity. The contribution which is intrinsic, because it has some completely unknown intrinsic noise, because contrary to telescopes, pulsars cannot be isolated and characterized in the lab. So this intrinsic noise is completely unknown. And so the intrinsic, the autocorrelations of two pulsars has zero information whatsoever about gravitational waves, because we don't know, we cannot say it's, and we know it's like piece A plus piece B, but I have no idea what piece A is. So the only way to get piece B, which is gravitational waves, is by looking at cross correlations. That's just what I'm saying here. But again, please let me keep going and we can discuss this all you want, because this is not really the point of this this talk. And in fact, what I'm saying has been known and stated very clearly in the PTA literature. Okay, so the NanoGraph collaboration does not claim in any way that they've detected a gravitational background. They call it a common process. The analysis is perfectly valid. Within the assumptions that they make, they get a detection of something which is a common process. As they say, they cannot call it the gravitational wave background. So I'm not saying anything really different from what they're saying here. But beware of not publishing a bunch of papers saying, oh, well, they've detected gravitational background, because they haven't and they don't claim this. Okay, so shall I move on? After this long unplanned criticism of the presentation of the results. So this is a criticism of the presentation of the results rather than the results themselves, to be clear. Okay, the analysis is perfectly valid within the assumptions that they have made. So we arrived at this equation where basically the cross-correlation power spectrum of two pulsar timing residuals is some linearly related to the intensity of the gravitational background. Okay. Now to make contact with things that you may have heard before or not. So if I now assume that I have an isotropic gravitational wave background, I can get this out of this integral, and what I'm left with is this integral over directions of the sky, of the gravitational background, of some pairwise timing response function, which depends on the two directions of the pulsars P and Q. If you do this integral over the sky, this will result in a function that only depends on the angle between the two pulsars. And the specific functional dependence is the Hellings and Downs curve, which was computed in, I forgot to put the citation, but I think 1983, okay? So the point here is that if I assume an isotropic gravitational wave background intensity, the cross-correlation of two pulsars still depends on the angle between these two pulsars. Okay, and this comes from the quadrupolar nature of gravitational waves. It is often, this curve is often referred to as a quadrupole. It is not a quadrupole. This is a function which has some logs and horrible functional dependence, but it starts at the quadrupole, okay? So this is a sum of Legendre polynomials of P dot Q starting at L equal two, but it has all the harmonics beyond L equal two. So let's build this Fisher matrix. So I'm just going to summarize the steps, and you can look at the details in the paper. So the first step is to construct quadratic estimators for the timing residual cross power spectra. In reality, you do so for band powers, because otherwise you get some infinite noise. So these I denote by hats here. This is exactly analogous to constructing estimators for the CLs for the CMB. Okay. Then we're going to approximate the distribution of these estimators as Gaussian. This is equivalent to doing so for the CLs, for the CMB, for high enough L so that you have enough independent modes. And here you could do so if your band powers are, if your frequency bandwidths are large enough, essentially. The covariance matrix, we're going to approximate it in the weak signal limit. And since those are related linearly to the gravitational background intensity, this Gaussian approximation for the timing residual power spectra translates to a Gaussian likelihood for the gravitational background intensity given some timing residual data. Okay, so that's the overall process. Before showing you this Fisher matrix, I want to make some quick definitions. So this.
Yes. Question here. So how many, up to what L can you reach in the previous slide, like L max for a given pair of detector?
This is for the CMB. I haven't talked about any L at all. So I'm going to show you some L stuff, but there's no L mentioned here for gravitational waves. This is just saying I can build, so this is a power spectrum, a cross power spectrum, and I can build an estimator of this cross power spectrum, just like the CL is a power spectrum of the ALM, so I can build an estimator in the same.
Okay, so you're going to bring it later. Okay, fine.
I haven't talked about L's yet. Yeah. For now, I'm just trying to build the Fisher matrix very generally.
Sounds good. Okay.
For the gravitational background. Yeah. So one more piece of notation here. So this is the intrinsic noise of each pulsar P. So we are going to translate this into a characteristic strain. So this has units basically of time squared, so multiplied by frequency squared. And this thing in the denominator is some transmission function, which accounts for the fact that when you fit some low frequency, some smooth timing model to the pulsar timing data, you are going to lose information at low frequencies. Okay, so this can be computed knowing the fitting procedure. And so for example, the code HASASIA, written by Jeff Hasboon and described in this paper, computes for each pulsar, individual pulsar, can compute these effective noise strains, okay? And so the idea here is that you get this, so you cannot make a Fischer matrix without any information whatsoever about the noise of your instrument. So just like you, if you build a Fischer matrix for the CMB, you need to know the typical noise in your detectors and angular resolution. And this needs to come from characterizing your, you know, your instrument noise. So here, the equivalent is that you can characterize individual single pulsar, estimate their auto correlations, their, which is their total noise, but in the weak signal limit, it's dominated by their intrinsic noise. And this is all you need. You don't need to build a Fischer matrix. You don't need to actually do cross correlations, but you do need to have some estimate of the auto correlations. Okay. All right. So let's then write this Fischer matrix. In the special, you can write it very generally, but in the special case, to start with, that the gravitational wave background is factorizable into some frequency dependence and some angular dependence, okay? So as I said before, the likelihood of this now angular dependence will depend on the data in some Gaussian form, where this A hat can be built from the data explicitly so. This F here, so this dot product again is a double integral here over omega and omega prime, the directions of gravitational wave in these two sides. This matrix F, which is basically some inverse covariance matrix in pixel-pixel basis, is built out of the sum of some coefficients times these pairwise timing response functions. So basically this summarizes the geometric properties of your pulsar timing array. And this coefficient here accounts for the noise properties of each pair. So here it's basically the inverse noise weighted integral of the frequency dependence of your assumed frequency dependence for a gravitational wave background. So basically here, this Fischer matrix, again, is a theorist simplified attempt at summarizing the essential geometric and noise properties of your pulsar timing array. So we're gonna do a couple warm-ups. First, we're gonna do a warm-up for an idealized PTA. And then we're gonna check that, you know, this gives us something sensible for say the monopole, comparable to what other, with existing limits before moving on to other things. So as a warm-up, let's consider an idealized pulsar timing array made of a large number of identical pulsars distributed isotropically on the sky. Then this Fischer matrix, you can show that it's going to be proportional to the sum over all pairs of the products of these timing response functions. And this, in the limit of a large number of pulsars, is going to go to a function which depends only on the angle between the two. This can be calculated. This was one of the hardest calculations I've actually ever done. It's in an appendix that no one's going to read. It involves rank 4 tensors and all that stuff. But you can actually compute this function in this infinite identical pulsar limit. And this is just to show you that this is a good check of our code to make sure we can compare our code to some known analytic limit. So this is the Fischer matrix for as a function of two directions in the sky. So in general, this Fischer matrix does not depend on just the angle between these two directions. It only does so when you have a large number of pulsars, which are isotropically distributed and identical, which is the black curve here, this analytic limit I was just talking about. So if you have just 10 pulsars and I try to distribute them as isotropically as possible, on this plot, you don't have a function, but you have all this, you know, scatter plot. But as you increase the number of pulsars to 30, then to 90, you see that this scatter plot, this Fischer matrix, actually does converge to this function of angle only as expected. So that's a good check. The second interesting thing that we'll get back to, hopefully towards the end, if I have time, is that we can decompose this function now on, you know, the Legendre polynomial basis. Hence, I can show that the spherical harmonics are the eigenmaps, the eigenfunctions of this Fischer matrix. And we can compute the coefficients, which are just the harmonic, the Legendre coefficients of this function. And again, we can now do so with a real distribution of pulsars, again, still isotropically distributed with the same noise properties, and see how this converges to this infinite pulsar limit. So this is with 10 pulsars. Those are the principal maps, the first five principal maps, with 30 pulsars and with 90 pulsars. And you see that you converge to a monopole. And so if we go back here, the first map is the L equals zero, a monopole. The second one, in terms of the next highest eigenvalue, is L equal two, is a quadrupole. And then you have L equal one, which is later. So you see that the in ordering the maps in terms of decreasing eigenvalues, we get monopole, and then we get these quadrupoles as expected. And thirdly, if we look at the evolution of the eigenvalues, this is showing as we decrease the number of pulsars from infinity to finite number, how we lift the degeneracy of the eigenvalues, just like you would do for a quantum mechanical system whose Hamiltonian you perturb. Okay, so this is exactly the same mathematics as perturbation theory for, as the degenerate perturbation theory for quantum mechanics. Okay. All right, so after this just brief warm up to make sure our code also worked properly, we could also reproduce some of the results of paper by Hotlini and Kamienkowski and others who basically worked in this idealized pulsar limits. So let's now apply this Fischer matrix to the European pulsar timing array. So we didn't do it with NanoGraph because there were some data release issues, but we did it with the European pulsar timing array, which constitutes of 42 pulsars, which have been timed for up to 17 years. So the first step is to obtain these characteristic noise trains, which again require analyzing each pulsar separately. There are no cross-correlation involved here. So it does require some data analysis, but not the full-on MCMC, which requires all the pulsars at once. It's really one at a time. So the first thing we want to make sure is that we reproduce the monopole sensitivity. So given this Fischer matrix, we can estimate the signal-to-noise ratio squared, okay, which is just a dot f dot a. And if you apply it to a pure monopole, so this is the typical, the standard you know, notation for this HGWB. Then your dot products here are just gonna be the Hellings and Downs curve. Okay, so your signal to noise ratio squared is gonna be some amplitude of the monopole characteristic strain to the fourth power times this sum here over all pairs. This is the purely geometric factor, Hellings and Downs, and this is characterizing your each pair's noise properties. Okay, and then you can estimate the 95% sensitivity by setting the signal to noise ratio to 2. Okay, and that gives you some AGWB 95% sensitivity. So we did this not with the full, at first, not with the full 42 pulsars. It's very easy to do so with our Fischer matrix, but we wanted to compare to existing results. And existing results for the EPTA have only used 6 pulsars. They've used the 6 pulsars because they were estimated to be the best pulsars for deterministic searches of gravitational waves, which are continuous. If you have a single binary, they call them continuous waves. So what we found with this Fischer analysis is a 95% forecasted sensitivity of 3.4 times 10 minus 15. And this is compared to either 3 times 10 minus 15 or 3.9 times 10 minus 15 obtained by the EPTA collaboration with different sets of assumptions. These are upper limits. So you see that this sits right in the middle. And so this tells us that we're not off by orders of magnitude. So this simple Fischer analysis reproduces at least the monopole quite accurately. And moreover, what we can do now, having the simple tool, is we can make forecasts, as I said. And so we can show that with the full EPTA, you would get a significantly better sensitivity if you were to use all the 42 pulsars, 2.5 10 minus 15. And so instead of using the six pulsars, one should not think about what are the six best pulsars, but rather, if you look at the SNR squared, it's a sum over pairs. So you cannot, it's not really meaningful to say what are the six best pulsars for stochastic gravitational wave background searches, but you can actually rank pulsar pairs according to their contributions to the SNR squared, which is what we're showing here. So for example, we're showing that with the 42 EPTA pulsars, which gives you 861 pairs, so that would be a bit, that's a lot of pairs to account for. If you could somehow, you know, only use 44 pairs in your Monte Carlo analysis, how to do so is a separate question, you would still be able to recover 90% of the SNR squared. Okay, so this is one example where this Fisher analysis could guide real data.
So what drives that?
What drives what, sorry?
What drives that? Which ones are the 44 best pairs? I mean, so your analysis gets it, right? But intuitively, what drives that?
So what drives it? So this coefficient here, there is first the angular, the geometric part. So this Hellings and Downs function is maximized if the two pulsars are close to one another. So if you have two pulsars which are far from one another, or which are at some angle where you have a zero of the Hellings and Downs curve, they're going to have a smaller contribution to the signal to noise ratio. And secondly, this is basically an inverse noise weighting of each pulsar pair. So this contains some integral over the specific shape of the gravitational wave background divided by the noise squared of each pulsar pair. So it's driven by both the geometry and the noise of each pulsar pair, but it's really a pair. So because this contains the noise of each pulsar. Does it make sense?
Yeah, I see. So also that means that towards like going towards larger samples, then it's not trivial how the SNR is going to scale. So say that you multiply, yeah. Say that you have 10 times more pulsars. So how is the SNR going to scale?
I mean, if they all had the same noise properties, then the SNR square scales as the number of pairs, right?
Yeah.
If you know, this HPQ is like some order unity geometric factor, but this is what drives really the noise. Is this? But
is that what happened with your projection in the last slide? You went from 3.9 to 2.5, 3.4 to 2.5.
Yeah, no. So this is if they were all equal noise, but they're a very, very unequal noise, which is why you only need 44 pairs out of 861, the 90% of the SNR squared.
I see. Okay.
So one can make scaling arguments like this, but they really only apply when all the pulsars are identical in noise and they're vastly different in their noise properties. And it's not only the noise. So you can have a pulsar which has a very low intrinsic noise, but if it hasn't been observed for a long time, it still doesn't contribute very much. The observation time also matters a lot in this
business. Yeah, so that's what I'm wondering. So where is the observation time? Where does it enter?
This enters, so I'm gonna probably have to go over time, but so in these, let's go back to this transmission function stuff here. So this basically is going to cut off, is gonna give you a large noise at frequencies below 1/1 the observational period. So these spikes are correspond to 1 year because there's some degeneracy because of the motion of the Earth around the sun when you fit your timing model. But so the lowest here, you know, the minimum of these noise curves depend on how long these pulsars have been observed. So the longer they're observed, the more you shift to the left.
I see. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Yeah.
Welcome. Okay. I'm definitely not going to finish this talk, but all right, let's keep going. So this is for the monopole. So now what's interesting is to go beyond the monopole. So first, a very important point that might seem obvious, but needs to be made, is that this Fisher matrix is built out of n pair timing response functions, gamma pq, okay? So this, even though it's a continuous matrix in, you know, pixel-pixel basis, really it's a matrix that has a rank n pair. Put differently, there in the overall space of, you know, infinite dimensional space of gravitational wave maps, gravitational background maps, there is an n pair dimensional space, which is spanned by this response functions, which is observable, which has a non-zero projection onto the Fisher matrix. And then there is a infinite minus n pair dimensional space, which is completely unobservable. Okay, which is completely invisible to the pulsar timing. So one can only at most constrain n pair independent components of the gravitational background angular dependence. Okay, so now how does one use this to search for anisotropies, this Fisher matrix? So I'm sure several of you have worked on Fisher analysis. So the idea is what? First, let's say that we have some prior knowledge of the kind of basis maps on which my gravitational background can project. So I assume that my gravitational background amplitude is some linear combination of some known maps, spherical harmonics, coarse pixels. And we want to estimate the sensitivity to each one of these amplitudes. So first you stop and you're like, do I have fewer coefficients than pairs? Good. If that's the case, you can proceed. If not, go back to the previous step. So then you can build a covariance matrix of these coefficients, which is obtained by taking the inverse of the discretized Fisher matrix, if you want, which is obtained by dotting these maps into your continuous Fisher matrix. And then you can estimate the sensitivity to each one of these coefficients, but they're all going to be correlated, okay? But you can estimate sensitivities by taking the square root of the variance. So a couple examples, you can use as a basis function some coarse pixels, for example, the Heelpix pixels. Here we have 12 pixels, here we have 192 pixels. Here we did it with the full 42 pulsars of the EPTA collaboration. So what I want you to, so these are the 95% sensitivity estimates. So what I want you to take away from here is that the overall scale here changes dramatically when I go from 12 pixels to 192 pixels. Okay, the sensitivity degrades very, very dramatically. Moreover, in each one of those cases, I can also ask what is the sensitivity to the monopole, the average of all of those pixels. And this also degrades as you increase the number of pixels quite significantly. Another example is that you could use a spherical harmonic basis. So Shuvadip had a question on this.
That's right. Right.
So this is the first time I'm, and so, so several other, so there are a couple other works which looked at this. So in order to do this analysis, you need to have a cutoff in your Lmax. And what this is showing is that the sensitivity to your, you know, power spectrum, if you want, because this is power spectrum of a power spectrum, degrades again significantly as you increase Lmax. Okay, so there is a very strong dependence on the assumed cutoff. Okay, so again, to repeat this, the issue in this kind of analysis where you assume some set of basis function, which, you know, this basis functions, if you're trying to cover all functions of the sky, it has an infinite number of constituents. And so you need to have some cutoff. And the forecasts that you get are going to depend on this cutoff for the standard set of basis maps, coarse pixels on the sky, spherical harmonics, okay? The reason for this is that the standard basis maps, which are purely mathematical constructions, are statistically correlated because your pulsar timing array has doesn't really care about your mathematical construction of spherical harmonics, okay? Unless it's in some idealized pulsar timing array with a large number of pulsars isotropically distributed on the sky. But in general, these standard basis maps are going to be correlated and how many you account for will change the overall sensitivity to the maps. So to use this kind of analysis, you better have some very robust priors on the basis map. For example, you can search for a monopole. If you are really can prove from physical principles that you don't expect or you expect very small and negligible anisotropies. Okay, so this, then it's very valid to look for a monopole only. But as soon as you open up the space of anisotropies, you need to have some really robust prior on what is my Lmax cutoff, what is my, you know, pixel size cutoff, otherwise your results are depending on this. So the interesting question is then, how does one agnostically search for anisotropies? And so Neil, can I take like 5 to 7 minutes extra to finish?
Oh yeah, yeah, definitely, of course.
Yeah, sorry, yeah. So how does one search agnostically for anisotropy? So there is a publication by the EPTA, members of the EPTA collaboration, where they produce what should be an agnostic search for anisotropies, because they produce an upper limit map using only this expulse search, which gives you 15 pairs. So in other words, they set some upper limits on 12,288 pixels using 15 pairs. And again, here they also assume the same frequency dependence. So you know that this cannot possibly be an upper limit because this problem is vastly under constraint. Okay. So what we could do is we could actually reproduce the results, understand exactly the results. They're using some more Penrose pseudo inverse to derive this. And it turns out we can show mathematically that this map really represents some constraint on the observable components only of the gravitational background, i.e. on the component of the gravitational background, which projects onto the n pair dimensional space that is spanned by these response functions. But there is an invisible component which can be arbitrarily large. So one cannot claim upper limits given that there's an entire component of the gravitational background which is completely undetectable to PTAs, okay? So we could, by understanding this, we could make a forecast for their maps. And you see that even though the amplitude is slightly off, but it was the case also for our monopole, the overall features are strikingly similar. And we cannot expect to get exactly the same results because of course they're using a realization of the data. And here this is some typical, whatever, 95%. So we could produce an infinite number of such realizations and they all look, you know, qualitatively similar to the results. So the bottom line here is that there are currently no upper limits on the gravitational wave background in each pixel because this is an ill-posed problem. Okay. And just to drive the point further, if you were to use rather than 6 pulsars here, you would use only 2 pulsars, then you know there's only a one-dimensional space of observable maps, and your upper limit would look a lot better by a factor of 7 or so, because you know basically these pulsars observe, the 6 pulsars can observe 15 components, but the noise of the 15th component is really large, and this is what dominates this map. And here they only observe one component, which has a lower noise. So again, just to say that these are not actually upper limits. If you want to do upper limits on a pixel by pixel basis, you can do so, but you need to use a small number of coarse pixels. So how can one search for anisotropies agnostically in principle? One can use as a basis function the eigenmaps of the Fisher matrix. Okay, so these are n pair statistically independent gravitational background maps. By statistically independent, I mean that their correlations noise correlations are zero, cross correlations are zero, and they span the space not of all possible gravitational wave background maps, but of the all possible observable maps. And so one can search for the amplitudes of all these principal maps simultaneously. It doesn't matter where you put your cutoff. You're not going to increase the noise of each map because they are statistically independent. Okay. The issue, of course, is that you can only constrain this observable space, but this is always the case. So basically here, what one can do with these principal maps is search under the lamppost of pulsar timing arrays. And this is in some sense, the best thing you can do. You can search under, if you're completely agnostic, that's the best thing you can do. If you're not agnostic, you should look for the specific map that you know from other priors that should be there in the data, like the monopole. But if you're completely agnostic, then this is the best thing you can do. This is showing these principal maps for the EPTA 42 pulsars, ordered by order of increasing noise. So this is the map with the lowest noise, et cetera, et cetera. This is showing you how the noise in terms of characteristic strain increases with the principal map. You see it increase rather steeply. And so one can do, again, this fully agnostic search, but then one has to give up the monopole as a preferred map. You see that the monopole is not one of the eigenmaps of pulsar timing arrays. This looks sort of monopolish, but it's not a perfect monopole. So there is some choice to be made. So as a sort of a neat little game here, that one can reconstruct in principle the observable part of the gravitational background. And this is something similar to what one does for interferometry when one builds dirty maps. Okay, and this procedure could probably be made much better. So here what we've done is say, okay, suppose that you can search for the amplitudes of all these principal maps simultaneously. Again, there's no need to put a cutoff. It's not going to influence your noise. Then you can say which maps have a signal to noise ratio greater than 3. And I can define my reconstructed map by dropping all the ones which are not measured. Okay. So this seems like a really dirty trick. And in fact, it is what is called, again, a dirty map in radio interferometry. So in radio interferometry, you measure visibilities, which are basically Fourier transforms of the sky map. And the dirty map is obtained by only accounting for those that you measure and dropping all of the infinite information which you don't measure. Okay. So note that when you do so, of course, your reconstructed map still has formally an infinite error bar because there's this whole unobservable component which you're dropping. Okay. So it's how to interpret this map is just like, you know, how one interprets the visibilities in radio, the dirty map in radio interferometry. There's something to keep in mind. So this is just to show you as a fun exercise. This is the input map. Either we have a fully isotropic gravitational background, or this map, which is my personal theoretical model of the gravitational background. And so far, no one has proved me wrong. And I think it's going to take many years before I'm proven wrong. This is my model of the gravitational background. And this has exactly the same monopole as this map. Okay. And now what I'm going to do is crank up the amplitude of these maps and show you what, given the EPTA, what would be the reconstructed map. So if you crank up the amplitude already to basically 3 times in strain, 3 times the, which corresponds to a signal to noise ratio of 10, okay, this would be SNR of 10, you would only measure 3 principal maps with signal to noise ratio greater than 3. And there's no way to distinguish the two. If you crank it up by another factor of square root of 3, you would measure order 10 principal maps with SNR of 3. And again, you know, there's not really much we can say between these two maps. And here, if you crank it up yet another factor of square root of 3, you could sort of start seeing the G here. Okay, but this would be now excluded. So this is 10 times the strain amplitude. And since the SNR goes as strain squared, okay, this would be, you know, excluded with 100 sigma, basically. Okay, so it's really unphysical amplitudes given the current limits. So the conclusion here is that, well, currently, and emphasize this, PTAs are really blind to anisotropies. And this is not that unexpected, given that there hasn't yet been the detection of a single number. Okay, so one cannot really expect that we'll suddenly be able to measure all sorts of anisotropies, given that yet so far, there hasn't been the detection of the monopole of the gravitational background. So in the paper, I'll just mention it here briefly, we also present an alternative approach, a frequentist approach in philosophy, where we examine the best fit chi-squared, or the best fit monopole, I should say, and ask if this best fit monopole, if the chi-squared has values which are consistent with what we expect statistically from a pure monopole. So basically, this frequentist approach allows us to assess whether there might be, you know, anisotropies in the data or not, but not their specific shape. Okay, so we basically highlight an approach where one could say, okay, the data is consistent, is inconsistent with the monopole with such significance, but the detailed shape is, you know, not, one cannot extract the detailed shape. So let me conclude. So first on anisotropies. So an important point, which seems simple, but was not necessarily accounted for in the past, is that with n pair pulsars, if you assume a frequency dependence, you only get to measure n pair independent components of the gravitational background. So one can search for anisotropy, so beyond the monopole, But if you use standard anisotropy, spherical harmonics, coarse pixels in the sky, because they are statistically correlated, you're going to degrade the sensitivity depending on your cutoff. So instead, you can use principle maps to look for anisotropies under the lamppost. So you can build your basis function tailored on your instrument, which is the best you can do if you are fully agnostic. But with current PTAs, at least with the EPTA and likely with all current PTAs, this would require very large signal to noise to be able to really detect anything beyond the monopole. So future work, first, if we're completely agnostic about the detailed realization of gravitational impact on anisotropies, but we can expect some shape for the statistical distribution of the gravitational impact on intensity, which itself is a power spectrum. Okay, so you can think of a direction-dependent power spectrum. Other extensions, and this is something I alluded that the fact there are other sources of correlations, which I didn't mention in this talk. One can make the Fisher analysis more general, more realistic by accounting for the fact that you could have other sources of correlated noise between different pulsars. So all the pulsars have to synchronize their times of arrivals to some global clock. If this global clock has some fluctuations, well, this will lead to a correlated time residual fluctuation in all these pulsars. All the pulsars also rely on knowing exactly the solar system ephemerides. And if you have some error in this, then you're going to get some also correlated timing residuals in all your pulsars. Beyond what we've done, we only consider the weak signal limit. So it's really a simple first step in this building this Fisher matrix. So what could one could, for example, think, what about, hopefully we will detect the monopole. What if we assume that we have a monopole plus some weak anisotropy? What would be the corresponding Fisher matrix and what are the forecasts? So the overall, as a conclusion, the overall goal here, this was a very first step in trying to build some forecasting tool, some tool that doesn't require running time-consuming Monte Carlo Markov chain analysis, and that could allow us to quantify, hopefully accurately, say what could hundreds of pulsars that the SKA could detect, what can we expect to measure with them. So I'll stop here and I'll take questions if there are more questions. Sorry for going over time.
Okay, great. So thanks very much, Yassine. So let's all unmute to give him a round of applause for a great talk. Okay, in view of the time, people should feel free to go if you're late for something. But if not, so let's open up for any further questions with the speaker. So feel free just to jump in and pipe up with any questions.
Yeah, so I want to come back to my question on LMAX choice. Mm-hmm. So how does that depend on the frequency of the signal?
What exactly is your question? Because what I'm showing is here is for a given frequency dependence. I'm sorry, let me again play in. Okay. Oh, I have to share again. Did I stop sharing? Oops.
Yeah, I stopped sharing.
Okay. Yes, I wanted to share this screen. Okay. So here, what it was showing is that if I assume some frequency dependence, depending on my choice of LMAX, what is my sensitivity? So can you frame your question in this
context? Right, so you are assuming I guess a kind of a fixed power, a fixed spectrum to measure the set LMAX.
Yes.
So what I'm asking the question is, if I take a range of frequencies of the gravitational background, how the LMAX sensitivity or your Fisher information matrix changes for different frequencies?
Right. So to be clear, here I'm not saying that I am sensitive to anisotropies up to some LMAX. It's a different way. I'm saying if I pick LMAX arbitrarily, then say my sensitivity to the monopole, to the dipole, when I go from LMAX equals 2 to 5 to 10, really worsens terribly. And it's the case for any single one of the Ls. So there's no, if I could somehow extend this to maybe sufficiently high L, there might be some turnaround where you could say that there's a, or yeah, there would be rather like a, you know, an exponential, you know, we would hit a wall where you could say, determine some L max, but I suspect that you need to go to a really high L max, which we haven't done this exercise. I mean, the matrix you're inverting when you get a large number of L's. So here, what it would be, well, what's the L max here? It would be something like L max squared or something. So you have something like 100 by 100 matrix. And as you crank up your L max, you're going to have a poor, more and more ill-defined matrix that you have to inverse to compute your covariance matrix. So we haven't done this exercise of asking, what is, so I think your question is, what is the angular resolution of a PTA?
Right.
I cannot answer this question with this L analysis.
Okay.
There might be some other ways that one can answer it, but I have not answered this specific question with an LMAX analysis. What you could do is look at your Fisher. And so first of all, you're going to have an angular resolution, to be clear, which is pixel dependent. Okay, so this Fisher matrix is like some inverse of the covariance matrix. So if I have F of omega comma omega prime, I can say, I can see how this F decreases as I move from omega to omega prime. So I could define some locally, some angular resolution, but this is then going to depend on the pixel.
Yeah, because I was asking this to understand whether there's a fundamental limit on the Lmax, which will come from different frequencies and picks and how close the pulses are.
Right, yeah. So there probably is something like this, but I think it's not easy to put in a symbol. I mean, maybe one could make some kind of map of the characteristic angular resolution as a function of location or something like this. So we did, we have an, I don't know if I have it in the additional slides, if I removed it. Where we looked at a hotspot, for example. But it's not quite the question that you're asking.
No, it's okay, we can discuss it later. Thanks.
Okay, so any more questions for Yassine? Okay, so if not, let's stop here. So thanks again, Yassine, for a great talk.